You are tuned in to the NTD Broadcast Network presentation of Off Camera with Sam Jones. The best conversations happen off camera.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Off Camera. I'm your host, Sam Jones. And in this episode, I sit down with actor Michael B. Jordan. Drug dealer, football player, alcoholic, shooting victim. In his first decade of acting, Michael B. Jordan has found ways to humanize characters that, on the page, may seem stereotypically what he dubs the black guy. In The Wire, a young and very sheltered Jordan asked fellow actors to help him understand how to simulate a cocaine high on screen, and through that surreal experience, discovered his unfettered love of acting. In Friday Night Lights, Jordan started journaling as an acting exercise and amassed a detailed backstory for quarterback Vince Howard that made the character shockingly real. With Fruitvale Station, Jordan dug even deeper. Playing a real person for the first time, he inserted himself deep into the family of Oscar Grant, who was slain by a police officer on a train platform in Oakland in 2009. Jordan spent time with Oscar's former girlfriend, mother, daughter, and friends. The result was an intensely real portrayal of a young man in a film that exposes our country's ongoing race problem. Jordan's performance was nuanced, understated, and masterful. Perhaps his ability to play characters with odds stacked against them comes from his own desire not to fall into that lifestyle. Jordan started working very young, doing modeling and acting in commercials, and saw an acting career as a way out of the tough urban environment of Newark, New Jersey. In his words, he saw plenty of Wallaces, Bodies, and Avon Barksdales, and was determined to make a better life for himself. Not only does Jordan not want to just play the black guy, he also doesn't want to compare himself too closely to actors that came before. He says he doesn't want to be the next Will Smith or the next Tom Cruise. He just wants to be himself. When you are around Jordan, his optimism and ambition are infectious and endearing. He doesn't just want to star in films, he wants to produce them. He doesn't want to just be on television, he wants his own channel. And he doesn't just want to be the face of a studio, he wants to run a studio. At Off Camera, we wouldn't bet against him doing anything he sets his mind to. So pull up a chair and listen in.
Michael B. Jordan.
Sam Jones.
How you doing?
Doing good.
Well, I thank you for coming and doing this for me. I first saw you on Friday Night Lights and then discovered The Wire and realized that little kid is the quarterback on Friday Night Lights.
They turn out to be now, looking back,
probably two of my favorite shows of all time. So I'm a big fan and it's nice to have you here.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me, man.
Yeah. I got the sense, like right at the beginning, that I wasn't just watching another TV actor do his thing, but I saw a real humanity in that character, and I also saw I felt like there was a sense that you played him as though he knew, there was just a bit of a, the deck was stacked against him, like he was, he knew that he had an uphill battle in life in general. And I wondered if that was a conscious decision for you.
You know, one of the great things about that show was the writing. You know, yeah. And Jason Kadams is so talented and so, he's so good at creating and writing these characters with baggage, with a little backstory. And one of the cool things about him is being able to collaborate with him, So he gave me the freedom, a lot of times to write my backstory. And I would write a journal, from my earliest memory up until that day, and just kind of just go through, life, how was my day today? How do I feel about not seeing my dad? How do I feel about my mom being sick today? And it kind of gives you a jumping off point. So I guess it was kind of a conscious decision. It was a little premeditated to kind of give him these, these high stakes, going into it, and knowing that, right from the beginning, the character, any false move, he's going to jail. It just kind of gave me a lot of places to go moving forward.
Right. And the journal thing, that was Jason came to you and said, just do this and create your own backstory? Or, was it something where he told you how to do it, or was it something you developed?
is a tool. You know, actually, a buddy of mine, Nate Parker. He's a really talented actor, and we worked on this project, Red Tails, together. And I got learning. I'm always constantly learning from each job that I kind of work on, and. This is something that I picked up from him. He was like, Mike, whenever you feel lost, whenever you feel like you're not, 100% sure of who you are at that moment, write a journal. Start off with that day. And then, moving forward on the different jobs and the different characters that I played, that just got bigger and more and became, a day became a week became a month became a few months. And then I just kind of, now for every character that I do, it's at least 40 pages. And
no
it's,
kidding.
And it's, I got them like stacked up at the house. I saved the journals of these characters, they're like real life diaries for these different people that I've played. And it's weird. It is a little weird, but it works for me, And I always remember where I'm at. I can always go back to it and read it, just like in real life. Your own diary is like you're documenting your memories. You're documenting your life for the most part. So, Jason, right when we started working on the show, he sat down with each one of us, all the new characters, and pretty much, answered any questions that we might have had and went over. Like all of our concerns, how was my relationship with my dad? How many schools did I get kicked out of? How many times did I get locked up?
And did he have all those answers?
No, we figured it out.
He did.
And that was the cool part. Then he was like, well, Michael, what do you think? I was like, well, this is the first time somebody asked me what I think. And I was like, all right, well, then I just kind of took it and ran with it. And I just kind of went the extra mile,
Yeah, how do you write a journal about a fictional character? Like, you just start making up things,
yeah.
And you go, and the more you write about it, the more true it becomes.
100%. And then once you're believing what you're writing, then that's the magic. Then you got them. You know your person. You know who Vince Howard is. That's the fun part. It's whatever you want to create. You create your habits. You create your tics. You create your likes and dislikes in this character. Because I think acting is at its best when you can pull from your own personal emotions and give that to a character, because it's coming from the realest place possible. And,
right.
And I think there's no fake in that.
Now that show was shot very kind of documentary style and lots of moving cameras,
yep.
And. I wondered how much you were encouraged to improvise, or if that was part of the deal, like you had to improvise. Like how was that set up for the actors?
At the first dinner, I remember it was Matt Loria, Madison Berg, Journey Smollett, and we were sitting around the table with Michael Waxman and Kyle Chandler and Connie Britton and Jason Kadams, Peter Berg. We're having like the round table dinner and stuff like that. And I remember Kyle stood up and said, you're here for a reason. If you're not bringing something to the character, if you're not, we encourage you to ad lib, we encourage you to improvise, we encourage you to bring something else to the table. That's why you're here. And trust it. Like, nobody's gonna get on you about it. We trust you, and I trust you. And it was just like it was just a relieving moment. Like, okay, cool.
That came from Kyle. And how did that work in practice? Like, so say you've got a scene in the locker room, mm-hmm. and you got a couple cameramen roving around. I'm assuming they were all steady or
mostly
handheld.
Mostly handheld and steady cams. And Pete's in video. Peter Berg, mm-hmm. Or usually any of the directors that's kind of already directed an episode, in the past, or some of the past seasons or whatnot. They're yelling from Video Village. All right, Scott, pull back on the one. We need to tie it over here. All right, Mike, move camera left a little bit while we're delivering our lines, like in the middle. So it's like literally like it's always constantly changing and constantly moving. There's no marks for the most part.
Right.
It's just kind of like, go where you feel as though you want to go, move where you want to move, and we'll find you. That's kind of like his motto. We'll find it.
And, well, that's one of the things I love about that show is how much they're finding focus and how much lights are getting into frame and things like that.
Exactly.
Because I feel like it adds to the tension of, you feel like you're in the room with those people, and it's a big football team or whatever it is. You're in that room and people are moving and it's dynamic, right? So in those situations, is there a leader? Like, does an actor kind of, like say Kyle Chandler, does he take off and go down a path and you just have to like get on board, or,
yeah.
Or are you guys sticking to the script, or how much did you deviate from the script?
I mean, there was this one scene I was in the office talking to Coach about I think it was about like a job or something like that. It might have been like asking him for like a referral or something like that. And then somehow we're end up in the office, we're cooking bacon. Bacon has nothing to do with anything. It wasn't in the script. It wasn't anywhere, but he has a little
portable.
We're sitting there cooking bacon and we're delivering the scene over bacon. And then that was just a total improv that he decided to bring to the table that day. So like little moments like that, we're always kind of finding the magic and finding the freshness within the scene. We're just sitting there volleying back and forth. And it's just, we get into a rhythm. And then sometimes we'll be having a conversation with our eyes, like, are we done? Or are we gonna get back to it? And then it's like, all right, we're gonna get back to it. And then we'll get back on track. It's weird, especially after working with somebody for a really long time, you pick up on habits and you pay attention to looks and it's a feel thing too. It's a lot of fun.
You know, I think that he is, for that show and even for television, he's kind of the penultimate father figure.
No, definitely. I mean, he was the, you know, he was the patriarch. You know, he was the guy who, you know, the other guys wanted to be like, that envy, like, oh man, like I'm jealous of your relationship, of your moxie, of the way you handle yourself.
Right.
You know, you have to see some of yourself in that character, I think, for the audience member to kind of like really want to, for a guy, to like root for another guy and want to be like him and be like, all right, this guy's cool, you know? Like we're not, guys don't, naturally, we don't give guys props off top. You know, we don't give them a lot of compliments. We don't give other guys a lot of compliments. It's just the way we're built, the way we're wired. So for Kyle Chandler, when you see other guys like, oh man, he's a cool guy, or I want to be like Coach, or like that father figure, that coach. You know, it's he sets an example for a lot of guys out there. And then I think a lot of women, you know, they all wish their husband at home was like Kyle Chandler or like Coach in some way. It's like Kyle is such a good person. So Coach Taylor almost has to be in some ways, you know, like that, his good heart comes through for sure. I remember he was telling me the story about, you know, after work, you know, he wasn't allowed to, he couldn't come out to drink that often, you know, bars, when we usually get done pretty early, you know, on that show. We never really shot long hours, very quick, fast pace. We got finished fairly quickly. And, you know, his wife gave him a bag full of change. You know, and like that was his drinking money. You know? So he would carry around like this big, like, I don't know if it was a big sock or a bag full of like, you know, quarters and nickels and dimes and pennies and stuff like that. And that's what he could drink with. But just little sacrifices and compromises like that, you know, within like your own relationship, you know, it just kind of like, you know, for me, for a guy at that age who was, you know, just now starting to, you know, fall into love and deal with those type of relationships and finding those little moments that, you know, he still gets what he wants, but at the same time he sacrifices for the betterment of the family, and then just being responsible. I mean, he's a very responsible guy, and I think I learned that just always being prepared, always being ready, and never making any excuses. You know, don't make excuses. It's definitely something I learned from him.
I think that for men especially, it's really important, depending on who your father was or whatever, it's really important to find a few mentors in that area and just how to be a man.
Exactly. You know? Yeah, definitely. And then like, you know, on the acting side, you know, it's weird because sometimes I feel like, you know, actors of that generation or older generations are very precious. Some of them, you know, are very precious with information. Like they're not as giving of like, you know, hey man, come, like, you know, taking somebody underneath their wing, and he was one of those, you know, those actors that definitely, you know, showed me little tricks of the trade. Okay, right here we're shooting on the 35, so it's going to be about, you know, this, you know, it's going to be this frame up. So when you walk in, you know, do something with your hands, you know, because you know it's going to be, you know, in the frame, and you know, right now we're shooting on the close now. Now walk up, and then I'll walk up. Now you see that walk? No. Let's go back to the, you know, like have a stand-in, come in and stand in. I'll come back to the Video Village and he'll show me on the monitor.
Really?
Okay, now you see where that's at. It was like little things like that, that, you know, I never went to acting school or film school or anything like that, but that was my education. He learned, taught me a lot, man. Just little things, like little tricks to the trade that's gonna make, you know, that you can tailor your own performance moving forward on the next job. It's just tools that I'll always have in my little utility belt.
Well, I think that's interesting, especially on a television show, because you're with the same crowd for such a long time that it is, you can go to school on it, right? You start to learn you can see the work. Like on a film, you go out, you do 8 weeks on a film, you don't see it until it's done, and exactly. You can't go back. But on a television show, you can look at the first episode yep. and go, "Oh, what did I do?" And you know, and so did you use it that way, like almost
definitely.
Like a.
I mean, like,
school.
I mean, you can see it. I mean, the first episode, I guess it worked for the rawness of the character and the fact that he was so new and unpolished. Because, like, I mean, I was learning at that time. And then, like, you know, halfway through the season, you kind of get in your groove and you're feeling, you know, confident. You're in your routine. And it's like, okay. And then, you know, at the end of the season, you're like, I'm in full stride. I'm in my groove. Like, let's keep going. And then that kind of carried over to season 5 because we didn't really have a break period.
Right.
And so I was in the zone at that point. Season 5 was just like, let's go to work. You know, that's the first time I actually had the material, you know, as
right.
an actor to really like dive in, you know, like you're doing episodics here, episodics there, you're doing one episode. You don't really get a chance to get into a groove. It's like playing basketball one time a week. It's like you're playing at one time and then like, you know, you're down for 6 days and then you come back again. It's going to take you a while to kind of get back in the rhythm. And you also don't have a lot of chance. You don't have a lot of time to really go into character on episodics. You know, on a television show, you can build this character over a period of time and really like get to know who that guy is. So it's a different pace. It's a different arc.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I mean, if you said to any actor, hey, you get to go cut your teeth on The Wire and Friday Night Lights. What a great opportunity.
Yep.
You know, we did a photo shoot a little while ago for Vanity Fair, and That was a fun shoot.
Yeah.
And you made a joke at one point. I forget the context of it, but you were talking about your mom, and you said, I was talking about different roles you played, and you said, yeah, my mom's already seen me die 5 times.
Yeah. I can't do that to her anymore, man. My mom is like you forget that, you know, you don't forget. You just like you just don't pay attention to it at first. Like my mom is watching her son die over and over and over again, like dramatic deaths. So it's
yeah.
like my mom would cry really hard. Like she would take it. My mom was very emotional. She would take it really hard. And you know, I remember, you know, after Fruitvale, she saw a screening of it and she was texting me that night. And oh man, this text. It was like maybe 3 o'clock in the morning, I just woke up to the text, and she was like, Bukhari, because my middle name, Bukhari's like, Bukhari, don't leave me. You know, I'm like, I miss you and all this other stuff, and I like, just don't leave me. And I'm like, I had to call her, like, Mom, listen, you're not allowed to watch any more of my movies if you can't hold it together. I need you to hold it together. Like, I just had to talk her down, like, you know, like, Mom, you know, I love you, and like, don't worry about it. I'm not going anywhere, but it's just, you know, just like I take my work home sometimes when you embody a character, you know, and you lose yourself, you know, you're depressed a few days afterwards, you know, it takes you a while to kind of snap out of it. You know, for my mom, I guess it's the same way in her own version of that, you know, as she seeing me kind of go through it, it sticks with her afterwards. And especially being around, like from Newark, New Jersey, you know, you see so many friends and, you know, relatives that are, you know, pass away. You know, at a very young age, you know, death is not uncommon, unfortunately. You know, like young males, you know, in the inner city, it's just rapid loss of young life. And so I know for my mom, it's like, it's always a real thing that can happen. And for her, it's scary to like see me go through that, you know?
I can imagine. I mean, I think that it's really close for a parent, especially the more real the project, that you can project out and imagine that. And and you started young, right? When you got the audition for The Wire, how old were you?
I think I just turned 14.
14.
Just 14, yeah.
Was your mom and you at the same time sort of aware from the beginning of that show what kind of a, I don't want to say depressing, but what a tragic story arc that The Wire was.
Oh, no clue.
No clue.
No clue. I mean, we were supposed to get canceled after season 1. We didn't even know, like, that show wasn't supposed to go on for 5 seasons. Like,
but thinking of the, you know, I mean, it's such a crazy thing.
Yeah.
You're playing this character, Wallace, who's dealing drugs, and you're taking drugs, and you're living in the projects, and people are getting shot and you're being used by the adults,
yeah.
which is probably the biggest tragedy of that,
yeah.
of that story. And I wondered if when that, you know, when those storylines were coming up, were you having dialogue with your mom about, you know, was she using it as a teachable moment?
No, I think it's a, you know, I was like a, I was a reoccurring role on that show.
Yeah.
We got the scripts as they came in. So usually we would read it. And then once we realized, like, you know, by episode two or three, you know, you realize that nobody's safe. You know, it's like this game of you know, of Clue, you know, or like who did it? You know, it's like who's gonna be next? You know, they're literally, when you get the script for the next episode, you're going through it, like you're just skimming through it just to see if your name's gonna be in the end.
Right.
To see if you made it through the end of the episode. And but like growing up in Newark, New Jersey, it's you know, I'm from the hood. You know, I saw plenty of Wallaces and Bodies and Avon Barksdales that they're all, you know, good friends of the family, you know, people that I see on a day-to-day basis. So it's like, I think a part of, like, you know, Wallace was, for me, playing him was just imitating, you know, my environment for a while. And my parents did a really good job, you know, of keeping me out of that life and keeping that, you know, keeping me, at, like, just that wasn't my world, but... I mean, it was my reality, you know, like for sure. So, so I've always got that lesson. You know, it wasn't just a show. I've always got the lesson from my dad being a Marine. You know, being you know, highly, you know, involved in, you know, Black Panther Party. You know, during his heyday, you know, up out here in California, my family being very, you know, conscious and aware. They keep me and my brother and my sister pretty, like, in line. So I never had that problem or worry from my parents. But they've always kind of taught me as we went along. But that storyline, like, on Wallace, it was an incredible, looking back at it, you know. At that time, it was just like I was a kid, you know.
Right.
Kind of imitating, like life, you know. And then I think the first time I fell in love with acting, the first time I lost myself in a role ever was... you know, the episode that Wallace started using drugs. And it was one of the first times in my life where I had nothing to pull from.
You'd never done
I
that.
I mean, I'm 14. I mean, I've never, you know, seen or, you know, touched, or I have no idea what it feels like, nothing. So I was like, this is the first time where I'm like at a total loss for words. And Andre Royo played Bubbles, you know, took me to the side and he was like, Mike, you know, this is what you gotta do, you know? So close your eyes, nobody's here. No cameras, nobody. You know, when you sniff the, you know what I'm saying, like the drugs or whatever, you know, coke, whatever it was at the time or whatever, you know, feel it, you know, hit your nose, it's gonna burn. You know, you kind of talk me through how it's gonna feel. Relax, you know, from the top of your head down to your toes. It's gonna feel warm, like the best feeling you're, he said, like, best piece of pussy you ever had. And I was like, all right, at 14, I'm like, all right.
14, well, I don't know what that feels like.
I feel like
either.
All right, yep. I've had maybe one piece. Okay, I know what that one piece is like. All right, got it. and he said, just lose yourself. Just, you know, whatever feels right, you know, say it. Whatever feels right, that's how you move. Whatever feels right, just do it and feel comfortable and confident and knowing that this is a safe place for you to kind of like go there. And I did it, and I remember just not feeling like myself at all. It wasn't Mike. You know, it wasn't me at all. And afterwards, like the next day, I was just down. I was feeling really down and just kind of like, you know, a little sad or whatever. And he called me up. He was like, "You okay?" I was like, "I'm good." He's like, "Yeah, yeah." He's like, "You're gonna feel like a little weird, but you did a really good job." Like, he encouraged me, man.
Right.
Like, literally. And that's when I fell in love with just acting. And I always wanted to kind of try to, you know, chase that feeling of losing yourself, you know, and you try to find it in different roles here and there, but you don't always get it.
Now, looking back, you're what, 26 now?
I'm 26, yeah.
26. Looking back, like, the day of the audition for that show,
yep.
What would you give your 13, 14-year-old self, what advice would you give that kid now.
It's completely out of your hands. You have no control over this audition. You have no control over, Don't stress out. Because I remember stressing out. Like, I remember, like, afterwards, I was so upset that I didn't get it. You know, because I originally auditioned for Bodhi.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, and they told me I was too young, and that, they said I did a great job, but I didn't get it. Alexa Fogel, I love her, she's awesome. And then they end up calling me back for Wallace. And then, you know, and then I read it and end up booking that one that day. But I would just tell myself, just period, not even just for that show, that one show, just auditions period. It's just like, it's not, once you leave that audition, it's not in your hands anymore.
Like, you know, it's funny, a kid can really think that. I mean, you think of a younger kid, mm-hmm. goes through a divorce, you know, parents go through the divorce and the kid's 8 years old.
Yep.
9 times out of 10, the kid is going to think that it's his fault.
For sure. You're not equipped. You're not emotionally equipped to handle that at that age. And I remember just, you know, being, you know, very sad, crying, you know, being depressed. And like my mom and dad, I think that was the first time that they ever really questioned whether they were doing the right thing by letting me like become an actor or kind of go down this path.
Yeah.
Like because they were the ones that had to pick up the pieces. You know, they had to. You know, you want McDonald's? I do want McDonald's. Like, Happy Meal with a toy. No, it's just like they were there. They had to pick up the pieces, and then slowly, you know, they never went through it. You know, like I'm the first generation in my family. You know, entertainer.
Right.
So I'm learning all these things on my own, you know?
And they were probably learning how to be a parent of a first generation entertaining kid. 100%,
yeah. 100%. So it was one of those things where, you know, I think after the Wire, like after that, all my auditions, I started throwing my sides away after I left out, you know? First audition, I would go in there and I would throw them away as soon as I walked out the door. I'll find a trash immediately, and I'll look for one, throw them away before I even get in the car. And then I always told myself, if I get a call back or if I really have to, if they really want me, I'll just reprint my sides. I didn't have a printer at that time. I didn't have anything
right.
like that. So I'll go to Kinko's. I'll go through the hassle if it's really worth it. But I left it all in the room. I'm walking out, hands clean. Let me just move on to the next thing. It's the only way I can kind of disconnect myself from the audition, from the role, and just forget about it and move on.
You still do that now?
Yeah, for sure.
Although you probably don't have to audition much anymore now.
I'm auditioning a little less, but I don't mind going to like hunt for my food. I think it's fun. It's a competition in a way. You know, I want to feel like I'm going. I want to feel like I worked harder than everybody else. So when I walk into an audition, it's like, you gotta have a little, not cockiness, but confidence to it, you know?
Sure.
Especially in that waiting room, it's a whole other thing.
When you see a bunch of yous.
A whole bunch of yous? No, for sure. Well, that's the crazy thing. Now the auditions, the roles I wanna go in there, I wanna be the only me. I wanna be looking around everybody else that doesn't like me and still go get it, you know? It's that competition, you know, and it's always the usual suspects. You see the same people all the time,
and right.
all the same auditions, and it's like, you know, especially when you start booking those jobs, now you're the guy that booked that are in the room with everybody else that hasn't been booked in, that hasn't been, you know, booking the job. So it's always that kind of, oh man, congratulations, you know, congratulations. Give you that,
exactly.
They give you the side eye.
Exactly.
Like, this guy, man, he's got to be on this audition. No, but it's a process, man. Auditioning is some actors hate it, and I know there's one point in time where I really hated it, and then I started to become more confident, and I guess the small successes built up your confidence, and now then you don't really mind going to auditions anymore. It's just like, I'll go in and read, let's go do it.
Yeah, for sure.
Let's go, like, but now it's more of a, now they're approaching auditions are kind of like, this is my take, instead of let me go try to give them what they want. Now your mind state changes to, this is my take, you know? Before, you know, you give me any notes or anything like that, let me just give you my version, because this is my take, and now it's a conversation. And then you realize the power you have as an actor. Like, once you're in that room, that's your time. You know, like that slow down time. Audition can be so fast. When you go in there, you know, milk it. You know, take your time. Like, you know, this is my moment right now. So let's hash this out. So what do you feel about the character? Because I was thinking, you know, right here on this line, you know, that, you know, he's not really talking about, you know, the girl he wants. He's talking about that last drag of the cigarette he just had at the bar. Like, that's what I thought that meant. And then it's open dialogue. Then now the director, you know, whoever you're reading for, it's an open conversation. It's a collaborative experience. Now you're making something together.
Which is what filmmaking is all about.
Which is filmmaking all about.
Yeah. You know, I think about kids working and sort of putting their childhood aside for this great opportunity that comes along. And you look at it and you look at the opportunities that you had, and it's amazing. You know, and yeah, there's the downside of maybe you don't get to have your whole childhood, you're working. But what I wondered about with you is coming from the area you come from and seeing, you know, the version of you that's out there without these opportunities. Do you ever think about what your life might have been like if you hadn't have found this thing that you love that you could immerse yourself in?
Yeah, it's, you know, coming from Newark, you know, and where there's not a lot of options, you know, like even if you go to school, you know, you get good grades, half the time you can't afford to go to college, you know, if you don't get a scholarship. So now you're taking out student loans and that you never seem to ever pay off because there's not any jobs out there waiting for you when you get finished, you know, graduating college. But I looked at acting as like my way out, you know. If I wasn't acting, I have no idea what I'd be doing. But I, you know, sometimes I look at my friends and, you know, friends, like, you know, they're still in Newark or whatnot. And the reality is you feel a little guilty in a way. When you were so close to living another life, you know, if I would have made one decision, if I would have made one left turn here or not have gone and did this, I could have just as easily been in that same vicious circle.
Right.
And that's the hard part to kind of, you know, get through kind of, you know, I know plenty of Oscar Grants and Trayvon Martins.
Well, let's talk about that because, you know, you just recently finished this amazing film, Fruitvale Station, which is about the real life story of Oscar Grant, who was killed in the BART transit system at Fruitvale Station. And what I took away from that film was how narrow Oscar's choices and his path seemed to be. You know, to me, that made that film all the more tragic, is that it brings into focus maybe how close we all are to tragedy or to someone that we know making a couple left turns or getting in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I think that, you know, that's one of those rare films where you can know exactly the story going in and you can still be completely and utterly moved, mm-hmm. and find yourself transported to a place that you never thought you were going to go with a film. But let's start at the beginning. I mean, you get this script from sort of an unknown director, and he says, I wrote this for you.
Yep.
What was that like? How did that unfold?
I just got finished doing this film, Chronicle, in South Africa, and I came back, and I was talking to my agent at the time, and I was like, you know what, I want to do an independent. I want to do a gritty indie that can, like, I think it's time for me to find me a lead, you know, for me to, like, kind of go show what I can do. I need to know if I can do it or not. Ryan, just so happens, Ryan is going through the process of casting this film, and gets the script to my agent at the time, and I read it. I remember bawling my eyes out halfway through, put it down, picked it up again, read it, and I was like, I got to meet this director. I got to meet Ryan. I got to talk to him. And met him at Starbucks. The first 5 minutes within talking to him, I knew I wanted to do it with him. And I was like, because you're invested. You know, he's so passionate, and his vision. You know, the way he described it, and the way he told me how he wanted to do it and why he wanted to do it. I was like, I just want to be a part of your vision. I want to be a part of this this process, and I want to help tell the story. And literally from that day on, I started growing my hair and putting on weight, and it was in my head I was doing it, and regardless of I would have done it for free.
Yeah.
So I mean, like it, you know, I mean it was pretty much for free, but no, it was I was really looking forward to doing it. I moved up to the Bay about a month earlier. Really want to soak up the Bay. I've never been to the Bay before. I've always heard amazing things about it, just how different it is from, like, you know, Southern California, how different it is from, like, you know, Texas, how different it is from Florida, how different it is from the East Coast. It's just its own thing. I just wanted to go up there and spend as much time as I could with the family. And
well, tell me about that. How did you meet his family for the first time?
I met Sophina, his girlfriend, first, with Melanie Diaz, who played Sophina, and I met Tatiana, the real Tatiana, as well, at a Starbucks.
Entire movie was made in a Starbucks.
Starbucks, right? We would like to thank you. Fruitvale Station, we would like to thank them. Was made and helped by Starbucks. Ryan kind of took, you know, Tatiana off to the side a little bit and let me and Melanie kind of, you know, have some one-on-one time with Sophina at first. And it was a little awkward, you know? I'm this guy in my head, you almost psych yourself out. Like, well, what is she thinking? She's gonna think I look nothing like him, and like I'm just this guy trying to be her boyfriend and all this other stuff. Like, I don't know, does she really understand like the whole process of this? And like, I mean, right. it was a lot of first times for everybody, you know, involved. And she was a little standoffish at first, but eventually, as we talked, she loosened up a little bit, and we just listened to the stories that, you know, she told about her and Oscar, and they were really best friends, and they were in love. They were so in love, and I just try to spend a little, like, you know, individual time with them, with each person, and just literally just listen. I didn't ask that many questions. You know, Ryan was the, you know, the gatekeeper to a lot of, you know, the family members. So, you know, we would usually wait for him to kind of set up the meeting, or depending on, you know, with his best friends, we end up going to a park and ordering a whole bunch of barbecue and, you know, sitting and drinking and, you know, telling stories in a park, you know, where Oscar used to hang out. And that's how I got to know Oscar. It was through everybody that knew him the best. And everybody had a different version of Oscar.
Really?
Everybody had a different, they described a different person. And I think that all of them were true. I don't think anybody, you know, made up anything, but Oscar was a different person around everybody, just like we are as people.
Yeah.
You know, he was constantly finding himself, you know? Oscar was a very complex young man. Young man, everybody keeps forgetting that he's only 22 years old. The fuck do you know at 22?
Exactly.
You know, that's the age you're supposed to make mistakes and experiment and not really know, not really have all the answers. And then you learn from those life lessons, and then moving forward, you apply that to your life and you decide what kind of man you want to be. Oscar never had that redemption period to decide what kind of man he wanted to be. So to be judged off of such a small sliver of time and like and growing pains, so to speak, I think it's completely unfair and unrealistic, you know?
You made a few choices. One in the flashback from jail when your mom comes to visit you.
Mm-hmm.
Where it was literally exactly what you're describing, where Oscar was a chameleon for protection, and you're sitting there across from your mom, and you're being that lovey-dovey mama's boy, that relationship that you
love so
you
much,
have.
Yeah.
And then another inmate comes in,
catches you in that vulnerable moment,
and says something, and you get up, and literally on the screen, we watch that kid disappear in your face. And that blew me away when I was watching it, is watching that character go away completely and a different, like, it's almost like you pull a Halloween mask down, this is the badass. And you were a different person.
Yeah, thank you, man.
And that was astounding to me. And it happened again on the train where you were with your friends, your guard was down, and then here comes this guy that you had a previous conflict with.
Yeah.
And boom, that face is on again. And I was blown away. You know, as much as I'm watching the film just as a flabbergasted observer and not knowing that whole story, those moments caught me where I really said to myself, you know, I didn't, as a kid, I never had to go through that. I could just be kind of, I always felt sort of safe.
Mm-hmm.
And Oscar Grant did not feel safe. And I wonder if that was something that you know, that you did on purpose, or if that was just something that kind of came from being that character.
I think if it's me and Ryan, we really, as much as we let ourselves have moments of magic or just kind of like of spontaneity, you know, we really dissected this script page by page. We really put a lot of time and effort into it, and we wanted to show how a young male has to be, you know, and that was in a position like Oscar, or just period. We wanted to show those changes, you know, stop on a dime, you know, changes in moments. And I remember the prison scene. He was just, you know, we were talking through it, and he was like, you know, you coming from getting searched, you know, mm-hmm. Like demasculated, you know, you're getting searched by another man, you know, butt naked, turn, bent over, cough, you know, and this is your routine before you go see your mom, you know, the woman that brought you into this world, you know, and then, you know, that walk to my mom is like, you know, you still got to have your guard up. And then you see her, and it's like, oh man, this is my mom. I can't really let her know what's going on with me. You know, I got bruises on my face. Obviously, I was getting into some shit, and you want to keep her ignorant of all of that. That's why I don't even acknowledge it.
You know, I think it was an amazing choice to play that character as unsympathetically as you did, and still get away with, you know, this total heartbreaking moment at the end when he dies, because I think he's shown in a very, very real light. It's hard to make a movie where you know exactly what the ending is in the first minute, and in minute 99, you're still feeling, I hope this doesn't happen. Yeah, I hope somehow I've gotten this all wrong,
Somehow it's going to end differently.
Yeah, it's going to end differently. And I think that's something that's so powerful about this whole story is that, you know, and I something I read that you said, where you took this film to festivals, and when the lights came up, you saw all these different people, different races, different ages, and they all had a universal feeling, you know, from this situation. And how can a theater full of completely diverse people live in the same world where this is allowed to happen?
Exactly, man. It lets us know that we did something right, that we're, you know, we're holding a mirror up to our audience, and we're saying, look at yourself in the mirror, and like, can you live with it? You know, like, what are you going to do to stop it from happening? You know, because I think it starts with the individual, mm-hmm. you know, to not be so quick to judge somebody that you deem different.
Exactly.
Just because you don't spend a lot of time around a guy like Oscar Grant or. But there's so many different things that play into that mind state and that the habit of thinking, you know, it's you know, whether it's media, whether it's, you know, how we're depicted in news, you know, and every time you see a, you know, black, you know, picture on a newspaper of these young males, some thugs, some degenerates. So like they're, you know, somebody from Wisconsin who's might not has ever been around, you know, a group of people like myself like that on a regular basis, you know, they might be a little abrasive when they come across somebody like myself because they don't.
Well, fear. Is it true? Unfamiliarity breeds fear.
Yeah.
And so you just, I think that's at our hearts, we're all that scared person that doesn't know.
We're all human. We're all flawed, man. It's like it's nobody's perfect, and it's just trying to figure it out.
I wanted to ask you if there was a specific story or something that one of his family members told you that sort of was the initial key that unlocked how to play him. Is there something that sticks in your mind that came from his mom or his daughter?
I mean, honestly, man, no. It was Forrest Whitaker that kind of really took the chains off me, man, and just really like just said, like, this is how, try this. And he said, you know, there's no video, there's no audio on Oscar, which is probably, you might think it's a obstacle, but it's probably your biggest asset right now, is because you have a clean slate of who this guy is. You take everything that you know and you've learned from his family and his friends, and then you go do your take. Don't imitate anything. That's the thing. Oscar can't, this can't be an imitation of anything. It has to be a representation of what Oscar was and who he is. And you're giving him voice. And it completely, like, I was like, okay. Because usually when you, like, when in your head, you kind of psych yourself out. I'm playing a real person. I have to be exactly him. I got to imitate this guy. I got to imitate this person, you know? But there's nothing for me to imitate. So it's like, how do you, now where do you find a performance? And you find it in, you know, you find it in his heart, you know? Like, you find out what he really cared about, you know?
But it's like your journal. You went around, you had barbecue, and you spent time, and so...
Built those memories.
Right.
You fabricate your own memories, and that's kind of how it happened. And then honestly, I'm not saying I got this shit down to a science. I mean, it was a lot of trial and error.
Sure.
It was a lot of on set praying to him. Honestly, like, hey man, I'm a little lost today. You know, like, just be here, be around, help me, just try to give me something. And like, there was moments for sure, he was around me, definitely, bro. And I can't take credit for that, you know? And it's like certain things, like certain, you know, things in scenes in this film and moments where it's just like, I want to give a really smart answer, but I don't have one. You know, I think it happens on with a lot of different, you know, characters and a lot of different actors. I think there's certain things that you just can't explain. It's like, well, that look you did here and that moment right here, well, what was going through your mind? I was like, sometimes you're so locked in tunnel vision, you don't even realize what you're doing sometimes, until later or somebody else pointed out. Sometimes you don't even really notice it because you're just so like locked in. And I know with this film, there's certain things there's a lot of things I can't take credit for. I was just a tool, bro.
How was the family's reaction to the performance in the end when they, after meeting you and spending time with you, and then they see the film?
His aunt stood up at Sundance and during a Q&A, and she was like, you know, Michael, there's certain, she's like, thank you. She's like, there's certain scenes in the movie where I couldn't tell the difference between Oscar and you. And that was the biggest compliment I ever could have got. That was the one comment that just took the weight off my shoulders. Like, okay, I don't care what happens from here on out. The family says it's good, and they approved that I'm good.
When you were preparing to go and do press for this film, mm-hmm. for Fruitvale Station, I'm sure there was not only an opportunity in your mind, but an obligation to, you know, to speak about certain things. Not just about the film and the individual experience of Oscar Grant, but mm-hmm. what that film brought up as a conversation about race in America and about not only your personal experience, but the universal experience of it. And did you see that as an opportunity where you could talk about the bigger conversation?
Yeah, it was something that, you know, like before, like not being able to really have a voice on certain things and not being able to really speak out like you really want to. And weirdly enough, I still didn't want to become the poster boy for, you know, racially charged topics.
Sure.
But in the same vein, I definitely, and it was also the weird timing of the whole Trayvon Martin thing, because mm-hmm. that was a very popular topic at the time while we were filming, and all through Sundance and leading up to the trial and all that stuff. I took an opportunity to speak about the project, to speak about that isolated incident, and then also touch on how it still happens today in the state of, you know, racism and being prejudiced in the United States right now, but not wanting to over talk about it and take credit for something that this tragic event, like, you know, trying to exploit the whole Trayvon Martin thing, trying to, like, you know, piggyback off that whole thing. So it was a weird balance that me and Ryan
because
really
tried
to play because of the whole timing of it all.
You said that you were trying to give Oscar Grant some of his humanity back.
Yes.
And that came to be sort of a line that was pulled out and highlighted a lot.
Yep.
What did you mean by that?
I meant when when there's an incident like this, you know, Oscar Grant's character gets put on trial and he's being judged by people that don't know him, you know? Everybody has their own agenda, their own bias, you know, way to spin it. Either he's getting painted as this degenerate thug, this monster, this villain.
Who brought it on himself.
He deserved it. Of course he deserved to die. I mean, what was he doing hanging out at a train station, coming back home, you know, New Year's, you know? Like, no, of course he deserved to die. Then you get, you know, the certain people that paint him as this perfect person that never jaywalked in his life, that never did anything wrong, and he was this saint, you know? And neither one of those are true. We wanted to find that middle ground, the reality, you know, and flaws and all. We just wanted to give him his humanity back. And
you did a great job.
Yeah, man.
You did, and I think that by focusing on the specific and taking it as one day in his life,
yep.
By making it that specific, you actually brought in the universal. And I think that's the beauty when it is taking your medicine and hiding it in the food. You know, mm-hmm. that if you could do it in a way that feels like it's all of us.
Yes.
You know, then you've done a good job. I also read that you said, you know, that you've played so many of these kind of characters. You've played the black guy a lot.
Yep.
And you have never played a doctor or someone that's in love or, you know, you went through some examples in a story I read. And, you know, I wanted to hear you talk about that in your own words in terms of playing the black guy versus, you know, a white actor is never going to have the problem of saying, gosh, I don't have the opportunity to play a doctor, to play this. Like, that's not a conversation a white guy has with himself in his head.
Yeah.
I mean,
I can play a doctor and a guy in love, but I don't know if it's going to be, I don't know if it's going to make it to the screens. It might be a home video.
Well, tell me about that. I mean, but that came from somewhere. That came from a frustration of, I'm sure, all the auditions that we haven't seen you go on where you're being asked to play that role.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the lack thereof, you know, of, it's like, you know, going back to what we were talking about before, like you've seen The Usual Suspects, you know, you go into audition, you know, there's like, you know, five, six, seven guys that I'm like, okay, I know I'm gonna see them in every audition I go into. And it's like, okay, cool. Because we're always being pitted, you know, for the same roles. It's not a historical figure or, you know, biopic on somebody, you know, it's like, where's the everyday man? Just, you know, that's going through regular life shit, you know? The firefighter, you know, the doctor, the guy next door, whoever, you know, it's just, there's not an abundance of roles out there, you know, for those characters. You know, I think it starts at conception. You know, when people write, sometimes the writers write, you know, for the black guy. This is a black guy, so I gotta, right. You know, there's a certain stereotype that's gonna come up naturally, you know? And I know myself, you know, playing roles like, I got fortunate to not get stereotyped. I played a lot of like roles that could be looked at as stereotypical, but the weight and the stakes were so high and so different. And it was a lot of love, a lot of heart, a lot of, you know, it was grounded that it was universal. But no, it's frustrating, man. You know, when, And it bothers me when you hear, you know, sometimes when I hear other, you know, actors, black actors, you know, say something like, you know, like Mike's taking all the roles or something like that. And I'm like,
as if there's just a couple roles,
yeah,
and you're getting them, because
yeah,
there's not all the roles that are out there.
Because, I mean, as humbling or not, like, I don't, like, you know, when you have a moment, you know, everybody wants that moment. And they want to be a part of that moment. So, you know, I'm having a lot more opportunities thrown at me right now, which is amazing. It's a blessing, you know, because I'm not saying I don't deserve it, because I mean, I fucking worked my ass off to get here, you know? And
sure.
But as black film, and it's not even just black, this film, like sometimes black film, like that shit bothers me too sometimes. Like, why does it have to be, they don't call it white film.
Right.
You know?
Like, take an example like Tyler Perry and say,
yeah,
that's black film.
That's black film.
And then there's a film that's like a Judd Apatow movie, and that's film.
Exactly. You know?
Well, it brings up the question of how you know, you're 26, you're at the beginning of what we all hope is a long, fruitful career, but how do you design that career in such a way that, you know, as much as you don't have any control as an actor, what have you learned now about how to sort of design a career that you want? And you know, it has this experience of Fruitvale Station with a fairly unknown director who made his own future.
Yeah.
Like, what, you know, do you think about that? How you want to design your career and what you can do?
Yeah, I dream about it every day. You know, I'm always constantly thinking about, you know, what I want to do. And I want to do everything, which is my problem. I want to play roles that everybody wants to go see. I'm not making films for one specific genre, for one specific audience. I want to be international. You know, I want to be at, like, you know, going to Cannes and, you know, and meeting these, you know, foreign investors and distributors and, you know, building relationships and realizing how much relationships, you know, really run this town, you know, in this industry. And taking the Tom Cruise and Will Smith model, like not being afraid to jump on a plane and go promote your film and get people in the seats and be a politician, you know, and that's a huge part of it as well. But dissect my career. I want to do film. I want to produce film. I want to star in film. I want to produce television. I want to star in television. You know, eventually I want to, you know. I mean, I want my own channel one day. I want my own studio as well. I don't just because it hasn't been done before doesn't mean it's unobtainable. You know, I just want to do things the smart way, man.
Well, I hear you saying that you want to start by breaking any stereotype that someone has of you and showing people what you can do, and then using that to shape your own path.
100%. I mean, I don't want to be directly compared to anybody. You know, even though, like, I'm me, man. I mean, I think that's what makes all of us different, is that we got our own thing. You know, yeah, there's some similarities between from you know, everybody, you know.
You don't want to be the next anybody.
I don't want to be the next anybody. You know, I just want to be me. And I'm going to do whatever I can, you know, my way, you know. And hopefully, you know, I continue to have people follow me.
Looking at what you've been able to do in such a short time
is
remarkable. And in some ways, maybe it even goes against your argument of I don't want to play the black guy, because you're not. You're far more successful, I think, even than maybe you're aware of now in how far you've already been able to come. Just forget black or white or whatever.
Yep.
You started when you were 14 in a serious role, and it's only been 12 years, and look where you are. And it's, for me, it's fascinating to watch, and I've just loved, you know, getting to know you through this conversation,
yeah,
but also,
man,
like, through watching on television and in films for, you know, the past 5 or 6 years.
Really,
pleasure for me to have you here.
No, man, I'm glad I was able to do it, man. This is so much fun, man. Even from, like, you know, we were talking earlier about, you know, like, photographs and stuff like that, and, like, how it's so hard for actors sometimes to, like, sit still and take, you know, and find these, you know, you're trying to get a snippet, you know, trying to get, just letting yourself go. And I'm not really a big, you know, I always get nervous when I do stuff like this. Like, my mom, and like when I started doing like The Wire, the first couple episodes, like right before we start, like, they said action, I would just start laughing. Like, I'll just start smiling and laughing. I'm like, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry, guys. I'm sorry. Like, I get nervous sometimes when I get nervous and you're so disarming. It's comfortable, bro. It's like,
thank you.
It's cool.
You have just finished listening to another episode of Off Camera. To access more episodes, subscribe, and be a part of the entire Off Camera experience, please visit offcamera.com. This has been a presentation of the NTD Broadcast Network.